Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I thought a great way to celebrate the return to work after the 4th of July holiday was to exercise our freedom of speech with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and political junkie. Ken Rudin, welcome to the show.
I can't believe our country has come down to this.
You're a celebration.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good.
Happy
How are fifth. You doing? Thank
Happy
you.
Fifth or sixth.
Sixth. It's the sixth.
That's right.
But it's so confusing when it falls on a Monday. So,
speaking
of freedom of speech, RNC Chairman Michael Steele, everyone's in a dither. Has he finally done himself in, or is he going to get elected president?
Well, I think more the former than the latter. Obviously, he has been in trouble in the past. He has said some inopportune, impolitic things in the past, and yet somehow it always goes away. The question is whether this will go away. Of course, with 4 months to go before the election, do the Republicans want to have this whole fracas become even worse than it is? But obviously, last Thursday, Michael Steele was heard at a Connecticut fundraiser saying that this Afghanistan was a war of Obama's choosing. I guess people forget that President Obama kind of inherited this war. Now, whether Obama has made it more of a war, more of an Obama war, that's one thing. But to politicize the war in such a way, it embarrassed many Republicans and it infuriated many Republicans like Lindsey Graham, like John McCain, like a lot of its leading senators saying that maybe it's time for Steele to go.
And it's had the ancillary effect of maybe pulling Democrats together a little bit because they've been split on the issue themselves.
Well, it's just like with the Joe Barton thing. President Obama and the Democrats were clearly on the defensive over what was going on with the response to the BP oil spill in the Gulf. And a lot of polls showed that a lot of people were blaming the president for the lack of action on cleaning up and stopping the spillage. And then Joe Barton, the congressman from Texas, comes out and apologizes to the CEO of BP and saying it was what the BP is going to have to pay for this was a shakedown. And the Democrats immediately had a rallying point. And the question is whether and the Democrats are clearly split on Afghanistan. Most of the Democrats in the House think that we should pull out, the U.S. should pull out, sooner than later and not wait for the Obama timetable. And so when you have a thing like Michael Steele coming out with this thing that he said, it again unites the Democratic Party on a position that they had not been united before.
What about the idea to dump Michael Steele and hire Sarah Palin? Sarah Palin's known for a few spoken gaffes herself.
Well, yeah, there are some conservatives that say that it'll be the best thing because everybody pays attention to what Sarah Palin has to say. But to dismiss Michael Steele because of a series of gaffes and put in Sarah Palin, who has had, as you say, has had gaffes herself, seems kind of weird. To me, the ideal was there was a guy named, and this is way before your time, Ann, was a guy named Ray Bliss from Ohio, who had been the Ohio Republican chairman. And after the Goldwater debacle of 64, Ray Bliss became the Republican national chairman. And he basically got the party united. It was not ideological. It was more nuts and bolts. Of course, now and today, you have more nuts and bolts than you have had before. But he had more of a nuts and bolts campaign. And it led to the Nixon election in 68. Ray Bliss was really the model, I always thought, for an experienced and a successful Republican or Democratic Party chairman, and there are not too many Ray Blisses out there anymore.
Now, Sarah Palin could definitely do something that Michael Steele hasn't been necessarily very good at, and that's raise money.
She does raise money everywhere she goes. She matter of fact, the pluses and minuses of a Sarah Palin endorsement are mostly settled in the plus column because she does get a lot of attention. She fires up the base, and she does raise a lot of money for the candidates. I'm not sure what Sarah Palin has planned for 2012. The fact that she's endorsing so many candidates in so many key races makes one think that she does have 2012 on her mind as in a presidential race.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe perhaps being national chairman might be another way of going doing it. That's what Howard Dean did after the 2008 campaign.
Right.
He was a successful, actually after the 2004 campaign, and he was a very successful, in my view, a Democratic national chairman, although not everybody in the White House, President Obama, Rahm Emanuel, may have agreed with that.
614-292-8513, if you would like to join our conversation, with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, political junkie. Give us a call, or you can go to allsides@wosu.org, or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. I am Facebook friends with Ken Rudin these days.
Mm-hmm. I would never admit that.
You know, Ken, I was reading a Q&A between you and NPR interns. I guess it's like a tradition. They interview people at NPR.
Yes. Yeah, well, I did. They printed more than I expected. Let me put it that way.
Well, you know, I was interested in their question, and you said it was the first time anyone ever asked it. I thought it was a good one too. Is what era would you have liked to, you know, if you couldn't do it this era, what era of president would you have liked to have covered in the past?
Well, you know, it is a very good question, and when you think of politics, you always think of these great campaigns and these great battles that went on in the country, and I never pictured myself in any other era other than what I've grown up in. But, you know, to have watched McCarthyism, to have watched the battle over slavery, you know, leading up to the Civil War, the battle over what to do with the economy on the way to the Depression in, you know, late 20s, early 1930s would have been a fascinating period to cover. Absolutely.
614-292-8513. I have Ken Rudin on the air with me right now. We're talking about politics as usual. Bobby Jindal has seen something of a comeback in the oily wake of the BP catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico. He's the governor of Louisiana, and I'm wondering, is this all going to turn out well for him?
Well, you know, it's hard to say that a tragedy like that, like what happened with the Gulf, turns out well for anybody. But
right.
Sometimes, you know, you could take advantage of it when there were terrible, horrific hurricanes in Florida. Governor Jeb Bush of Florida benefited politically. Bobby Jindal has been out front condemning BP, you know, standing up to Obama, saying that more should be done. And his numbers have skyrocketed, as have the numbers for Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the same time, if you go back to the Katrina, when there was another terrible, terrible tragedy that took many lives, yet the politicians did not benefit. President Bush, I think from the beginning, the real downturn of his administration was less so about Iraq and more about a lack of coherent response to what happened in Katrina. Governor Kathleen Blanco, the Democratic governor of Louisiana, decided not to run for re-election because of the way she handled or mishandled Katrina. So, you know, sometimes the best or the worst in politicians come out when there's a terrible crisis, and Bobby Jindal has benefited politically, at least, from what happened in the Gulf.
Well, of course, he sort of did a nosedive a few years ago.
When President Obama was newly elected and he gave a speech to a joint session of Congress on the economic situation, a lot of people called it a State of the Union address. Of course, this was a year before his first State of the Union address. Mm-hmm. But Bobby Jindal, a rising star in the Republican Party, was given the response time to respond to the president. And it was basically awful. It was choreographed badly. It was staged badly. It was very uncomfortable. And everybody was writing him off, Bobby Jindal off, as a potential presidential candidate. One, Bobby Jindal has never said he wants to be president. He always said his real interest is running for re-election. And two, remember when Bill Clinton gave that awful, it seemed like 4-hour-long speech at the 1988 Democratic Convention when he nominated Michael Dukakis or seconded Michael Dukakis. And, of course, the classic when Bill Clinton said, and in conclusion, and everybody applauded because finally it was over. And everybody said, boy, this guy's future is finished. And obviously that was not the case.
Well, and likewise, Barack Obama said he wasn't going to run for president either at one point, and he ended up doing it. So just because Bobby Jindal says he's not going to run in 2012, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, does it?
True. Could. I think a lot has to depends on what Obama's and the Democrats' numbers are by 2012. Mm-hmm. This time in 1994, Bill Clinton's numbers were really, really bad, were really poor, and a lot of people felt that he was going to be a one-term president. But once Republicans took control of Congress in 1994, President Clinton was able to run against Bob Dole, Newt Gingrich, and that congressional class, and gave him victory. So, you know, stranger things have happened. Harry Truman was going to be a lame duck until he ran against that do-nothing Congress in 1948. Whatever Obama's numbers are in November of 2010 obviously have nothing to do with what's going to look like in 2012.
All righty, 614-292-8513, and a caller from Worthington. You want to talk about General McChrystal's downfall.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Can you rehash the same thing again? I feel that everyone is tripping over each other, congratulating President Obama appointing General Petraeus to take over, I feel that that was not the best way to look at opportunity. I thought that the basic strategy we are pursuing in Afghanistan should be looked at and thoroughly discussed once again, because it's about to bring in Pakistan into the mix and expand that Afghanistan war into subcontinent, taking on Pakistanis' war against its own insurgencies. And I just feel that this was a missed opportunity for Obama administration to revisit the strategy.
Ken, would that have been wise, or was it wiser to move right along very quickly like he did?
Well, I like the question very much. Obviously, the policy has not changed, and the caller who did not give her name, I think, makes a very good point. For going from McChrystal to Petraeus doesn't change much. The fact is, it seems to be a failing policy, and I think that's why President Obama keeps talking about a beginning of a pullout from the summer of 2011. But as Joe Biden and others have said, throwing more troops into it is not going to be the answer, because, you know, the Soviets couldn't do it, centuries of foreign rule couldn't do it, occupation of Afghanistan, and Pakistan, with its own problems with its militants and insurgents, are really the big issue. So it's a quagmire not unlike Vietnam, and we'll see if we can get out of it.
Thank you, caller.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Thank you.
614-292-8513 if you want to talk with Ken Rudin, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. What's been going on in that House Ethics Committee? They recently interviewed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi regarding those allegations against now former Rep. Eric Massa of New York. Is that? They're supposed to be coming out with a report or something soon?
It's the same kind of thing that happened when the Republican leaders were asked about Mark Foley in 2006, Mark Foley being the Florida Republican who had inappropriate emails with underage pages, congressional pages, and of course, it was an embarrassment to the Republican Party, and they wanted to know what the Republican leaders knew about it. Same with Eric Massa, the former congressman from upstate New York, who had been complaining, you know, aides had been complaining about inappropriate touching and tickling and things like that Massa would do with, mm-hmm. with male aides. And I think that a lot of people want to know what Nancy Pelosi knew and when did she know it. For some reason, Eric Massa is not getting the kind of attention that Mark Foley got in 2006. But again, for a party that came to power in 2006, talking about the culture of corruption and the transgressions of Republicans in 2006, Democrats have some things to answer to as well.
So is do you think this report, I mean, is there any sense about what they're going to reveal, or is it pretty benign at this point?
Well, nothing's benign when you're talking about right. sexual misconduct like that and inappropriate behavior. But I don't know if the leadership gets blamed for it, but it's just another embarrassment. And, of course, I heard on your newscast right before the show began, speaking of embarrassments, that Jim Trafficant has not given up his numbers. His petitions have been mostly disqualified, but his staff still thinks he's going to get on the ballot as an independent in the 17th district. And if there's anything that Congress needs, it's more Jim Trafficants.
Yeah, I you know, Ray Bliss is a little bit before my time, but only because I didn't live here yet. Jim Trafficant, however, is not before my time.
Well, he's before your planet. I mean, you know, he is a character, and for many people who complain about how bland and white bread most of Congress is, Trafficant is kind of a, I guess you could say, I don't know if it's a breath of fresh air, but it's a breath of different kind of air. But look, the guy was corrupt. He was thrown out of Congress, convicted on corruption charges. And, you know, with Americans' view of Congress and elected officials at such a low stage, the last thing you want is a return of Trafficant to Congress. I don't think he could beat Tim Ryan anyway, but still mm-hmm. the fact that we're talking about it is just kind of sad.
Are there very many characters in Congress anymore, Ken?
No, there aren't. And, you know, you miss them. And, you know, they've always look, a lot of these people, they spend all their time raising funds to get reelected, and they go home every weekend to raise money and to campaign. And there's no camaraderie. There's no, you know, look at what's going on with almost every bill. Here's a perfect example. Back in February, there was a bill to extend unemployment benefits, and Jim Bunning, the senator from Republican senator from Kentucky, was the only Republican who campaigned against, who argued against extending unemployment benefits, and the Republicans were very embarrassed. They felt this was embarrassing their party, they shouldn't do this, and they basically talked Bunning into reversing his opposition. Now that's basically the Republican position on unemployment benefits. It's too expensive, we can't pay for it, and so the entire Republican, basically the entire Republican base, except for perhaps the two female senators from Maine, are against extending unemployment benefits. So there's just one party on one side, one party on the other side, and they feel that, you know, that's the appropriate way for the voters to decide what party should be in power come November.
We're going to have to take a short break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our WOSU e-newsletters.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care, on the web at isaacbrandt.com.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. Currently 86 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:22. Sunny skies today and hazy, hot, and humid for the rest of the week. A high of 93 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 71. Sunny for Wednesday and a high of 94. And sunshine on Thursday with a high of 95. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and political junkie over there. Ken, thanks again for being with us today.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
In the Al Gore department, the Portland police, do they look worse or does Al Gore still look worse?
Well, you know something? I mean, I never like these kind of stories. Mm-hmm. They're he said, she said, mm-hmm. and often we never know what the truth is, but look, the fact is that Al Gore was getting a massage in a Portland hotel a couple of years ago, about 3-4 years ago, and this woman decided to come forward and say that there were inappropriate gropings, and as a matter of fact, the AP, which is not known for titillating reporting, really was kind of specific about what he allegedly did. And so the Portland police decide that it will have to investigate these charges. You know, without taking sides, thinking who's right and who's wrong here. Anytime there's a charge of just, you know, sexual harassment, sexual inappropriate behavior, they should be investigated. I guess that's as far as I can go. You do know, of course, that on June 1st, the Gores announced they were separating after 40 years of marriage. And everybody said, oh, my goodness, you know, that they're the last people you'd ever suspect. But, you know, one, never knows what happens, and two, this could be, this allegation, this Portland, Oregon allegation could prove to be nothing. But the fact is, and the only reason it's worth talking about it, is that the Portland police said they will reopen their investigation.
It seems like we spend quite a bit of time, and maybe it's my fault because I bring it up, because it seems to be what people are also talking about, is these sexual harassment issues, these sexual indiscretions, that sort of a thing. Do you think they're ever going to learn?
Well, look, I know there is a tabloidization of the news, but mm-hmm. I kind of think there is a difference between if somebody is gay or somebody's having an affair. To me, that's really their own business. I don't think it's something that we need to spend all our time focusing on, or any time focusing on. But again, if it's a charge of just, you know, unwanted sexual aggression, whether it be an Eric Massa case, a Mark Foley case, or an Al Gore case, it should be investigated. And of course, Al Gore is not in public office, but he is a public official, a widely admired Democratic official, with his views on global warming and things like that. So again, if he was, I mean, there's a rumor, they actually, all the newspapers mentioned that there's a rumor that he was dating somebody's ex-wife, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care about that. Mm-hmm. That's between him and Tipper Gore and his family. But again, if there's an inappropriate sexual conduct, that is a different kind of issue.
Elena Kagan is supposed to be a shoo-in for the U.S. Supreme Court, but the NRA, which opposes her nomination, is keeping track of how folks vote. Is this going to be a problem, or only for them who depend on the NRA for support?
Well, it's more than just the NRA. The Republican Party, I mean, there were only 7 Republicans who voted for Sonia Sotomayor for the Supreme Court last year, and there seemed to be more of a case against Sotomayor than there is about Kagan. But I kind of think that what the Republican Party is doing is, one, they want to make the point that they feel that she's a liberal activist. Well, look, you know, it's amazing that we have to decide whether Thurgood Marshall needs confirmation or not. She was a clerk to Thurgood Marshall, who was the first black Supreme Court justice named by President Johnson in 1967. And the Republican Party is deciding all over again whether Thurgood Marshall is mainstream or not, as if. You know, we saw that with Rand Paul in Kentucky, whether the 1964 Civil Rights Act should be ratified or not. I don't know why they let themselves get into this conversation, because it's pointless. But I think what this really is that ultimately there's a strong possibility, or let's just say there's a possibility, that an Anthony Kennedy or even a conservative justice could decide to leave the court, either on voluntarily or involuntarily, while President Obama is still president. And if that's the case, that will be World War III. And I think that the Republicans are just keeping their powder dry, or they're practicing for what ultimately will be just, hell, because that'll be just an unbelievable fight. Elena Kagan replacing John Paul Stevens ideologically is not a major change. But I think the Republican Party and the conservatives want to keep this issue alive, because when it really matters, it will be an unbelievable fight.
Did the confirmations hearings bore you to death, or what?
Well,
they seem very boring.
You ask Elena Kagan what she had for lunch, and she says, "I have no comment because it might affect my, it was kind of silly. The irony is that in 1995, Kagan wrote this big, widely discussed paper saying these confirmation hearings are a joke, that they right. don't reveal anything. The nominees reveal nothing of themselves, and that's not the way they should be. They should answer the questions. And of course, lo and behold, Elena Kagan finds herself before the Senate Judiciary Committee and not saying a word. The best line of the whole thing was when they were asking her about the Christmas bombing a few years ago, and when the senator asked Kagan where she was on Christmas, she said, "Well, like many Jews, I was probably at a Chinese restaurant." Yuck, 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 yuck. Everybody's laughing. But ultimately, we got nothing out of it. I don't know any more about Elena Kagan now right. than I did prior to the hearings, except for the fact that she ostensibly has a sense of humor. But I think senators were looking for more. And look, Robert Bork was probably the last nominee who decided to tell everything about how he felt. And boy, he said a lot of things that senators didn't want to hear. And he was rejected as a Supreme Court justice under Reagan back in 1987. Many subsequent appointees, Supreme Court nominees since then, have learned the lesson of Robert Bork. And they just tell you nothing. Conservatives did that. Roberts and Alito did that. And liberals like, Ginsburg and Breyer do that as well, as is Kagan. So it's kind of like a waste of time, but I guess we have to go through the motions.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. My guest is the political junkie, Ken Rudin. He's NPR's political editor. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from a listener. Writes, to what extent can reliance be placed on the various quote-unquote fact-checked organizations to provide objective information that can help to clarify controversial political issues being covered in the media? Ken, do you use and feel confident in center fact-check groups?
Well, I have looked at some of them. Sometimes even, I'm always looking for bias, because even though everybody in the world sees biases out there in the media, I think there's a clear sense of bias from the left or the right, depending on the issue. Sometimes I know the Pew Foundation has a very good fact check operation going on out of St. Petersburg in Florida that I sometimes look at, and I think they're pretty much on the mark. But a lot of it is just, you know, I mean, everybody's expecting people to lie or misstate facts. And, you know, there's a scorecard almost every time somebody announces something. So I do look at it, and I think it does bring a service. But obviously there are more and more, you know, Pinocchios being given out there because more and more people are exaggerating stuff. We saw that with Richard Blumenthal in Connecticut. We saw it with Mark Kirk in Illinois, both about exaggerating or misstating mm-hmm. their military service. So I think it serves a good purpose.
You know, let's say you've mentioned in your blog at NPR that it's going to be a quiet July primary schedule. Can you talk about that? Let's see, we've got Alabama, Georgia.
We have an Alabama Republican gubernatorial runoff, which not many people are paying attention to. Mm-hmm. We have a race for governor of Georgia, primaries in both parties on July 20th. And then we have an Oklahoma primary on July 27th. Not the kind of exciting stuff we've been seeing for weeks. I mean, we saw with Ohio and Arkansas and Arlen Specter and the incumbents losing. We saw it with the fascinating stuff in South Carolina with Nikki Haley, an Indian American woman who may be the next governor of South Carolina. You may have the first black Republican in a long time in the House in South Carolina. You're not going to get that in the July primaries. But again, in August, you do see some good, exciting primaries coming up. Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, who's always been a moderate mainstream Republican, if not a moderate conservative, is suddenly being portrayed as a liberal sellout by the Tea Party, and her opponent is being backed by Sarah Palin. The reason that's interesting is because in 2006, Sarah Palin defeated Lisa Murkowski's father, Frank Murkowski, who was the governor of Alaska in the primary. So there's bad blood there. You see John McCain, who once upon a time was kind of moderate on immigration. He's in a tough primary now against J.D. Hayworth, a conservative, who says that McCain is a sellout, supports amnesty. Of course, McCain has really changed his rhetoric drastically when it comes to immigration. So that's a primary to watch as well. And so there are a lot of other incumbents teetering on the brink there who could go down to defeat in the primary, both Democrats and Republicans.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. For questions or comments for Ken Rudin. I was looking at that survey of presidential scholars that ranked President Obama just below Bill Clinton but ahead of Ronald Reagan in a survey. As you said earlier, things could change a lot between now and 2012, but still, isn't it a little bit early to be ranking? Or do they just this for fun?
Well, you know, I guess it's, you know, it's, I mean, ratings are always fun. You know, the greatest Nazi war criminals of all time. Everybody has a rating for everything. I don't know why they do that. But, you know, look at George W. Bush on September 10th, 2001. He was a 50% president. His whole presidency changed dramatically, obviously, on September 11th. He was reelected probably because of what happened on 9/11. And then when you think of him now, you think of him because his last 2 years were so terrible. The economy was bad. The Iraq war went sour. Then his numbers went down. So, you know, a lot can change between now and 2012, certainly between now and 2010. Obama's numbers a year ago were much higher than they are now. It wasn't until last year's town hall meetings where you heard these activists who were really angry about the state of the economy, where the country was going, distrust about Obama, where his numbers started to go down. So, you know, it's been in a time when everybody loves polls and they love, you know, polls day in and day out, which changed so dramatically. I think it's too quickly to judge not only President Obama, but President Bush as well. It took people a long time to decide that President Truman was a good president. For years, he was decided, you know, was rated as one of the worst presidents ever. He left the presidency in January of 1953 with polls in the low 20s, polling in the low 20s, and now people see him in much different light. So it'll be very interesting to see if the Obama numbers or the Bush numbers change as well.
Well, plus, I mean, they're scholars, so should they be looking at polling or should they be looking at, you know, the ultimate impact the individual might have had on the well-being of the nation?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's also part of, I think of that when I think of President Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, it was almost as if what he could do, the potential of Obama, and I never knew that you give out a Nobel Peace Prize for potential. I always think that you give it out for something for
I have a lot of potential, Ken.
Yeah, right. Ann Fisher, Nobel Peace Prize.
That's what they always kept telling me. You have a lot of potential.
Yeah.
What about Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, the late Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia?
Well, they're serious. They're talking about him replacing Larry King. No, that's a terrible joke. I'm sorry.
That is terrible.
No, that's a terrible joke. I apologize to our faithful audience. But, you know, a very complicated man, a very fascinating man, of course, as everybody pointed out, and nobody will forget that he started his career as a grand Kliegel with the Ku Klux Klan. He had many racist things to say in his early years in Congress. Of course, he filibustered the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. He voted against Thurgood Marshall, as did 10 other Southern anti-civil rights senators. But he, at one point, he decided he wanted to be a national Democratic figure. And to do that, he renounced his past. Do I think it was true to his word? Perhaps. We do know that he did support all the civil rights bills toward the latter part of his career. He, you know, his former positions, he said over and over again, were a mistake, an embarrassment. He went far further than Strom Thurmond or George Wallace or Jesse Helms, those kind of people who had strong views either on race or conservatism, by saying that I really renounce it. It was a mistake, and I'm sorry for it. And so at the end, he became not only the longest serving senator in history, the longest serving member of Congress in history, and a never a beloved figure. I mean, he wasn't a likable guy at all, but he was respected. Alan Simpson, who's a friend of mine, the former senator from Wyoming, who came to visit NPR last week, he said, you know something, did I love him? No, but I was always in awe when I was in his presence. And I think that's the feeling about Robert Byrd. He was a protector of the Constitution. They felt that he just, you know, was, if anything, loved the Senate more than anything else. But he, you know, clearly when you write his obituary, and people wrote his obituary the past week, it was a very mixed record given his early past.
Well, I guess testament enough that things change. People change. Or
people
maybe
change.
Not.
And it seems like, you know, again, there are some people who question whether he changed out of convenience or whether he changed because of opportunity. The point is he has changed. He did change. His voting record certainly changed. He turned out to be one of the more liberal members of Congress. And I suspect that whoever replaces him in West Virginia, and I suspect it will be a Democrat. It's interesting, even though Republicans are winning in West Virginia at the presidential level, no Republican has won a Senate seat there since 1956. So I suspect the Democrat will still win it. But whoever the Democrat is, and we expect it to be ultimately the governor, the current governor, Joe Manchin, he's a much more socially conservative Democrat than Robert Byrd.
We're going to have to take a short break, and then we'll return. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org to comment or speak with Ken Rudin. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Terry Gross, and I have about 15 seconds to explain why you should listen to Fresh Air. You should listen because, unlike this little promo, on Fresh Air we have time. Time to spend with incredibly interesting people in the arts, entertainment, and politics. Enough time that we get to know them. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And on Fresh Air today at noon, former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins, and also a discussion of a new biography of the life of Emily Dickinson. It's called Lives Like Loaded Guns and discusses her family feuds. That discussion on Fresh Air at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents a special Chefs in the City coffee tasting at Luck Brothers Coffee House in Grandview. It's Thursday, July 29th at 10:30 a.m. Join us to sample gourmet coffees and treats and get a coffee take-home from Luck Brothers. You'll also be a part of a special WOSU TV production and learn how to brew the perfect cup of coffee. There's a limited number of tickets. They go on sale this Thursday morning. For more information and to reserve your tickets, go to wosu.org/chefs. 87 degrees currently in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today and a high right around 93 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 71. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. And if you want to talk to him, 614-292-8513. And Alan, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ken. I just find it your political knowledge of history, and I'm not into politics, but I love listening to you because your political knowledge on the history of politics is amazing, especially when you do your quizzes and somebody comes up with the wrong answer. You're able to tell them exactly why they're wrong, which is just, I find it amazing and congratulate you for it. And it's caused me to really listen to your show, just to learn stuff. So
I appreciate that. Thank you. That's very nice to say.
Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much.
Well, that also came out in the NPR intern interview is that that is one of your special talents is a memory for such things.
Well, it's not like I remember. It's sort of like, you know, if you're a baseball fan, and I am a baseball fan, and of course I am a Yankees fan, and I should point out that the Yankees have not won the World Series since November, so it has been a tough year for me. But, no, that's obnoxious. And I know there was no such thing as
obnoxious. Well, that would be a Yankees fan.
Yeah, you'd never hear of an obnoxious Yankees fan. But you know, I love it. I love the campaign. I love meeting the candidates. I love meeting folks who years ago, matter of fact, when I mentioned when Alan Simpson came to visit NPR last week, I went down to greet him in the lobby, and I knew he was coming a day in advance. I came down wearing a button for Raymond Whittaker, the guy he defeated for the Senate in 1978. You know, you like to, because politicians love to talk about their campaigns and how they got there and everything like that. And I love it, too. It's just, you know, it's like, again, talking about great World Series victories, great baseball players of the past. I feel the exact same way about politicians.
614-292-8513. Oh, someone says the Yankees suck out there. Okay, we won't mention that on the air, though.
No. I understand. Look, that's fine. But I will tell you one thing. I grew up in a small town called the Bronx, so I really have an excuse. But I don't want, you know, and I know there's some. This came up in the Kasich race, the Kasich governorship. I don't want LeBron James to leave. I mean, I know that everybody in Ohio doesn't love the Cleveland Cavaliers. But I think it would be terrible if the big market teams get this great stars like LeBron. I would love to see Cleveland win a championship. And, you know, I love these small market teams like the Minnesota Twins who do so much with so little and so little money, and yet they're still competitive year after year. And I'm saying this as a Yankees fan. I don't like the thought of buying championships, and I know there's some irony in what I'm saying, but I really do believe that.
There's a lot of parallels between sports and professional sports and what's happened to it and politics and what's happened to that.
There is. There's, of course, you know, for somebody like me, as Alan mentioned before, there's trivia and there's lore and there's history and there's, you know, it's just, you know, when you mention 1966, I'll remember the Dodgers playing the Orioles in the World Series. I'll remember Ronald Reagan and Nelson Rockefeller and Mitt Romney George Romney,
right,
winning elections as governor. So you throw out a year and you just remember the past. And you know, I have no idea what I did, you know, what I had for breakfast. I have no idea where I put my keys. But I can tell you what happened in 1966, and that's scary. can I mention one more
but
thing?
Helpful.
Though?
Yes.
There was a woman who called earlier and talked about General McChrystal, and we were talking about the Michael Steele things. And I think these are distractions that not only the press is guilty of, but we're all guilty of, is that we're missing the big point. McChrystal, for what he said and saying that, you know, that the vice president is a fool and all these criticisms, and then Michael Steele criticizing Obama on the war. But the point is, we're still not asking the questions about what this war is supposed to accomplish and what can it accomplish. And so, you know, we could talk about personalities and McChrystal and Petraeus and all those things, but ultimately, it's just hard to imagine this war going well. And so every time you hear President Obama saying, well, we were going to start talking about a pullout in the summer of 2011. Then John McCain will say, well, I'm against any kind of artificial pullout. And then President Obama say, well, no, I would not pull out, depending on the situation on the ground. But I can't, you know, with what's going on in Pakistan, and Pakistan clearly has two motives in here, and most of it is not favorable to the U.S. It's just very complicated and ugly. And we have got to ask the right questions, a lot of the questions that we didn't ask before we went into Iraq.
So do you agree with her, though, that it was a missed opportunity to have that debate, or was it the opportunity to have the debate? Or it was a distraction, but wasn't that necessarily a foot in the door to have the discussion all over again at that point?
No, it certainly is an opportunity for Congress to have the discussion, and as they should. They did have a debate, a quick little amendment that was proposed to call for a pullout of troops that went down to defeat pretty overwhelmingly, even though a majority of 60% of the Democrats voted for it. And I think the Congress should have that debate. But for the president to say, well, no, nothing changes, our policy hasn't changed, that's kind of like you kind of roll your eyes and say, is that what you want? Is that the message you want to give? Obviously, you don't want to give an indication that there's disunity in the military. There's a problem between civilian control and the military folks who are fighting and dying on our behalf. But somehow, they have to be honest about what's going on there in the situation on the ground.
Any student of history knows that civilian versus military there's been tension there forever. This is nothing new.
Yes, but and at the same time, as General MacArthur learned, that there is a right way and there's a wrong way. And it's one thing to resign your commission and then complain all you want, but you don't stand up to the President of the United States, whether you're General McChrystal. Well, I don't think McChrystal stood up to the President, but he did make the unbelievably impolitic decision to talk to a reporter about his reservations about the President's leadership, and you just don't do that.
How do you think it was played in the Rolling Stone?
What do you mean? I'm sorry.
I mean the article.
What do you mean? How was it played?
I mean, there were criticisms that the reporter did it to just make a name for himself.
Oh, no. To blame the reporter for I mean, if anything, McChrystal showed. I mean, one thing you'll say about General Petraeus, he would never be that stupid. He, whatever you think of him, and remember, the left pilloried him back in 2007. MoveOn.org called him General Betrayus. Senator Obama was criticized General Petraeus back in 2007, and now he's the guy who's going to save the Obama war policy, which is pretty ironic. Look, the journalist's job is to find out the truth and to hear what politicians or generals, if the case may be, have to say. And if somebody is going to speak their mind and it's not off the record, there are no rules saying that it's not off the record, then to blame the press for this is just crazy. And Rolling Stone, as far as I could see, did nothing wrong.
614-292-8513. We got a call coming up here, but you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, in your blog post about Senator Blanche Lincoln's come from behind win in Arkansas, you mentioned that Bill Clinton might be the Democrats' biggest draw on the campaign trail this fall. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, it is. And you know, I think in your introduction, you talk about Chelsea's wedding. And no, I am not invited. But the last whenever I picture Chelsea Clinton, I always picture her as holding hands in the middle of Bill and Hillary during the worst part of the Monica scandal, because, you know, he was just so disgraced, you know, personally, you know. But there's been a, just as we always talked for years about this, the new Nixon. How about Richard Nixon was rehabilitated? Bill Clinton seems to be rehabilitated. I remember when he criticized back in the South Carolina primary in 2008, when he said, well, so what if Barack Obama won the primary? Jesse Jackson won it twice. And everybody said, oh, my God. But there seems to be a maturing of Bill Clinton, at least politically. And the fact that he can campaign in Southwest Pennsylvania in that John Murtha's district, where Barack Obama was so unpopular, and yet they still love Bill Clinton. The fact that Bill Clinton helped rescue Blanche Lincoln from the liberal left, which was interesting because the MoveOn.org and the Netroots folks really wanted Blanche Lincoln gone because of, you know, votes she took on health care and card check and things like that. So Bill Clinton is very, very popular, perhaps the most sought-after campaigner. That was so interesting. What I thought was so interesting is that he and Obama split in the Colorado Senate race. Bill Clinton is backing challenger to the appointed incumbent there, Michael Bennett. He is backing Clinton is backing Andrew Romanoff, who's more liberal, the former House Speaker of Colorado, who's challenging Bennett in the primary. And, of course, Romanoff backed Hillary Clinton for president in 2008. Michael Bennett backed Barack Obama. So a lot of it is personal and family-oriented. But it's interesting that Bill Clinton would make that decision.
Well, I don't know if you made the point or someone else I was reading about that, that's all he's going to do.
Yes. He's not going to raise money for Romanoff. He's not going to campaign personally for him. It is perhaps a thank you for what Romanoff did on behalf of Hillary Clinton in 2008. But again, it was the Washington Press Corps went ballistic. They said, oh, my goodness, it shows that it's Clinton versus Obama once again. And that means Hillary's going to challenge him in 2012. And
Well, if these niceties are typical, then I suppose that's inevitable when you have someone, that Hillary went up against Barack Obama in the primary and that you're going to have these paybacks along the line. Well, it could be years before they've paid everybody back.
Yeah, I don't think it's a payback. I don't think it's a shot across the bow at Obama, but I think it's just thanking him for appreciation for what he did in 2008.
Right. 614-292-8513. And Charles, you're on the air. What's the question?
Hi. This is a question, kind of a philosophical question.
Okay.
Will our country ever have the political will to spend money on preventive care as opposed to spending money on the catastrophic care that is caused when you don't spend money on preventive care? So in reference to this whole cutting off people with HIV from their medicines, obviously if you don't spend the money on preventive care, you just, in our country, when that person has an AIDS-related serious disease, we spend 10, 20, 30 times more money on catastrophic care. So the question, and this is not just with HIV, it's all across the board with all health-related problems. Will we ever have the political will to say, no, we're not? If there's a money crisis to be had, we're going to spend money on preventive care, and we are going to cut money off on catastrophic care. So that's my question.
Okay. Political will.
Well, that's a great question. And, that's one thing you don't see anymore. You don't see political will. And it just seems like whether it's health-related or foreign policy-related, we seem to look or the border with Mexico, we seem to wait till a situation gets so out of control and then it becomes catastrophic, and then we suddenly have to rush in funds. But the thought of preventive care, whether it's for health care or foreign policy, it just seems like we don't think that far ahead. It's a question that deserves more than a quick 30-second answer, but I think what Charles is asking is very important, and we don't seem to have the political will to think that far ahead, and we just don't.
Yep. Thank you, Charles, for your call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Take care. 614-292-8513. We have about 5 minutes left with Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, you can call us or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to All Sides with the Ann Fisher Facebook page. Ken, what do you spend the rest of your summer doing in a mid-year or a midterm election cycle like we're in now? You just kind of running around doing the primaries, or how does it work for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is like the best. You always keep thinking about how every year is so amazing, and of course, 2008 was historic. And mm-hmm. This is just an amazing midterm election. There seems to be so many ups and downs, and a lot of people were lazy in the beginning, and they said, "Well, this is a year of anti-incumbency." Well, as it turned out, maybe not so. That's not the case, because only two senators were defeated and three members of the House and one governor, and that doesn't seem like a tremendous outpouring of anti-incumbency. But there is unease out there, and of course, there's a lot to worry about with upcoming primaries, as I said, with Murkowski and John McCain and what's going on in Colorado between Bennett and Romanoff. And also, I haven't really focused that much on the House races because it's hard to get a handle on them, not knowing who all the candidates are. But we're talking about, Republicans could gain anywhere 30 to 35 seats. If they gain 39 seats, John Boehner is Speaker of the House. So there are a lot of things almost as we are beyond my control. I mean, obviously, we go as a primary at a time. Sometimes we'll look 2-3 weeks ahead mm-hmm. to look at the primaries. And, of course, you have to watch what's going on Capitol Hill with confirmations and votes and things like that. But ultimately, in the back of our mind, it's November, and even further back of the mind, it's 2012. Mm-hmm. And if Obama is seen as vulnerable, then some of the stronger candidates may come through. But, you know, if Obama is seen as a comeback, then maybe, you know, the Mitt Romneys don't run. You know, they sit back and give it to somebody like perhaps a Palin or a Huckabee or somebody who they feel they're running a more opportune time for them. It's too soon to talk about 2012, mm-hmm. but you know that everybody's thinking about it.
614-292-8513. Caroline, you're on the air. Did Ken answer your question?
Yeah, so I wanted to follow up with okay. that about Social Security reform. If he thinks that there is anybody talking about it in their campaign that they might be ready to say we ought to raise the age till 70 and that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, well, yes, and every time somebody does, they get hammered for it. I think Boehner has said that one of the, and I think President Bush has done that in the past as well. They've talked about one way to salvage the system, to save the system from becoming bankrupt, is perhaps you raise the retirement age to 70. But it's an untenable political position, even though financially it may make sense. But every time a candidate or either a challenger or an incumbent will raise something like that, they'll be torn down and saying, you know, that's irresponsible and that's not the way to go. And I think Boehner just the other day said something that we should consider going to 70, and he was ripped apart by Democrats. And, you know, these instant messages that come out that the Democrats are so very good at, you know, as soon as a Republican said something stupid, either Joe Barton or Michael Steele, they have these blast faxes. Of course, they're not faxes anymore. They're emails that come out saying that, you know, why this doesn't work. So there's just no political courage anymore. And even those who are retiring don't seem to have the courage to say things like that.
You know, the Columbus Dispatch just did a poll looking at it's partly because people don't want to hear the truth. They don't want to know what the truth is. And I'm thinking, well, what's new about that? That's always been the reason why they don't stick their necks out. Politicians don't stick their necks out is because the voters can't take it.
Yeah, but, you know, as Charles mentioned before in that earlier phone call, he said, do you wait till there's really literally no mm-hmm. money left in Social Security before you do something about it? Or do you make these kind of changes years in advance, hoping to, you know, to soften, not soften the blow, but to make sure that it remains solvent? And people can't think years in advance, let alone months in advance. So mm-hmm. it's just the political courage is just not there.
Caroline, thank you for your call.
Thank you. Take I'm care. Sure in favor of it being okay. Aged up. Thanks.
All righty. Take care. We have run out of time again with Ken Rudin, political editor for NPR. Ken, thanks for joining the show.
And you have a lot of potential.
I think you do too, Ken.
Thank you so much.
And I hope you have a wonderful July primary season.
I'll see you soon.
See you. Take care. That's all the time we have for the show. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Edible Columbus, a new magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the summer edition can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.